From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, post-Cold War, post-1990s holiday from history, post-9/11. No one argues that the world is not changing in dramatic ways, but there is a fierce debate at home and abroad right now about how America is responding to global change, in particular about the grand strategy that has emerged under the Bush administration. When things appeared to be going well in Iraq, the public rumble of that debate was muted. Now, with the Iraq mission off kilter and mounting global alienation from the United States, you can make the case that the need for the public debate is urgent. So we will have it here in this hour with two great protagonists tonight on Point, an emergency debate under fire over America's grand strategy in the world. Is America's foreign policy in the birth pangs of delivering a vital new global strategy? Or is it going off the rails? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Walter Russell Mead, Henry Kissinger Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the important new book, Power, Terror, Peace and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. Good evening and welcome, Walter Russell Mead.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's wonderful to have you. Also joining us tonight from Chicago is John Mearsheimer, Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He is author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, John Mearsheimer.
Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're both here. It has the feeling of a moment, Walter Russell Mead, when we're very happy for your new book as a kind of clarifying argument. We can agree or disagree with it, and we'll hear from John Mearsheimer and callers tonight on that. But there is a sense abroad, increasingly as Iraq has become difficult, that we have got a lot to think about here. You've been doing a lot of thinking very recently, and John Mearsheimer, we know you've been thinking right through this period of the Bush administration with some alarm, as you saw in particular what emerged in its strategic expression of the war in Iraq. We want to try and step back tonight and look at the big strategy that this is all unfolding within and what we make of it. Walter Russell Mead, let me just begin with you, if you'd be good enough. How would you define America's grand strategy right now, and do you support it?
Well, I think we're still, even if you talk to people in the Bush administration, I think people would say that we're still at a very early stage. I think most of us would agree that September 11th was a shock to American foreign policy, like the start of the Cold War, even Pearl Harbor. And if you think about it, it took us a number of years after we began the Cold War to have our strategy. Kennan publishes The Containment several years after Roosevelt and Truman realized that Stalin isn't going to keep his promises in Poland. You don't get NATO established till several years after that. As late as 1952, Nixon and Eisenhower are running against the idea of containment as our grand strategy in the Cold War, and they don't really buy into it until 1956.
So it takes time in response to traumatic events for new strategy to wholly emerge. At the same time, you make a powerful argument in your new book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, that there is a very strong sprout, bud, more than that, that's emerged here, that it has very strong roots in current American politics and society. And you have spent no small number of pages very clearly describing and defining it. How would you define it?
Well, I would say that I call it an American revival approach to our foreign policy, that a group of people some of them are defense intellectuals, some of them are sort of more from an economic and business perspective, some are the Christian right, large group of people have decided that the American century is only just beginning, that what we've seen since the first American century was just prologue. We're almost at a period comparable to the start of the 20th century when America first began to really assert itself as a great global power.
And their grand strategy in this second great assertion is what?
It's a mix of things. The neoconservatives believe that American values pushed strongly and pushed aside from international institutions like the United Nations and so on can transform the world. That was certainly one of the theories that shaped their engagement in Iraq. And you've also got people that believe that the changes in the American economy of the last 20 years as we become more deregulated, more dynamic, moved into services, more IT developed, technologically advanced.
What you call millennial capitalism,
exactly.
as opposed to the capitalism of Henry Ford, which was big factories and institutions.
That's right, and labor unions and lifetime job security and all that stuff. As we've made that change, it's unleashed a new era of American supremacy. So they see an ideological and an economic basis for a new kind of American power, and they see their job as to sort of use that power to change the world.
Are you on board with this?
No, I'm not a neoconservative.
But you read like a supporter. I mean, I can read you chapter and verse from your book where you appear to be pretty much in the amen corner.
Well, I think you can also read, you know, I'm an analyst of foreign policy, and I look at a lot of different schools of thought in this book and Special Providence. And I try to explain things sympathetically from the standpoint of the people who were in them. I'm not one of these people who's going to sit here and say the Bush foreign policy strategy is sort of completely wrong from soup to nuts. There is some merit in some of their ideas. But it would be very, very hard to resist the conclusion, and I talk about this in the book, that their failure to plan more adequately for a more difficult period in post-war Iraq was a disaster, that they underestimated the degree of anti-Americanism that they would encounter, the political cost of some of the unilateralism. So it's far from a kind of an unmixed verdict there.
John Mearsheimer, we read in Walter Russell Mead a kind of robust appreciation for this new grand strategy, the American revival, no apologies about a big new push. In fact, he says mandated by the sort of almost natural demands of millennial capitalism, some sharp critique of the tactics that the Bush administration has employed in Iraq and elsewhere, but essentially an endorsement, as I read it anyway, of this revival. Do you agree? Do you see this as the sort of defining, framing grand strategy of the United States right now? And do you support it?
Well, let me tell you what I think the Bush administration's grand strategy is at the moment, which I've always thought that Walter identified with. I think the basic focus of the strategy is on the Middle East. And it's on the Middle East because the two problems that concern the Bush administration and the country at large are most clearly evident there. The first problem is nuclear proliferation involving rogue states like Iran and Iraq. Mm. And the second problem is terrorism, where, of course, al-Qaeda is the main problem. And those problems are seen by the Bush administration as largely originating in the Middle East. And then the question is, what's the strategy that they've devised for dealing with those two problems? And basically, what they're trying to do is produce regional transformation. They're, in effect, trying to create liberal democracies in the Middle East. They're trying to make the Middle East look more like us because they believe that we're the good guys. And if we can make them look like us, then the Middle East will be populated by good guys and will live happily ever after.
You have an argument with that?
Well, the real problem comes in when you get to the issue of exactly how you do it. I think in principle, it would be good if you had liberal democracies in the Middle East, but their way of producing that outcome is with big stick diplomacy. They want to use the American military to shove democracy down their throats at the end of a rifle barrel, and that's what's causing all sorts of problems. And of course, Iraq was the first step down this road, and Iraq, as you know from reading the newspapers every day, has turned out to be a disaster. And the basic grand strategy is now washing up on the rocks.
And that strategy being an armed push of American values onto the Middle East as you see it.
Right. The question here is, why do they hate us? That's what concerns most Americans. Why is it that people in the Arab and Islamic world hate us? And the Bush administration and its supporters have concluded that they hate us because of who we are. And of course, we can't change who we are, so they believe that what we should do is change who they are. In other words, we should go in and turn them into liberal democracies, turn them away from Islamic fundamentalism, make them look like us, and of course we'll live happily ever after. And their prescription for doing this involves using big stick diplomacy. It involves using the American military. And of course the end result of all this is that they take a bad situation and they make it worse. They make the terrorism problem worse. And that's why we're worse off today than we were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. This is a deeply flawed strategy.
Walter Russell Mead, at some level, these things get very visceral, even in high strategy. You write that one must accept that others need to understand that Americans will respond to provocations like those of September 11th with massive and overwhelming force. Those who cannot stand us must learn at least to fear us. Is this a central tenet of Bush administration grand strategy as you see it?
Well, I would say, again, the way I write that, that's a fact about American political life. In other words, unlike, say, the Spaniards who, when the bombs went off in the train station, their sort of instinctive response was, let's disengage. We didn't like this in the beginning. Now we really don't like it. There's a sense in which Americans might rally around a very unpopular strategy, you know, rather than be seen to be stampeded by terrorism against it.
So you mean unpopular abroad?
Right, right, or even unpopular at home. You know, if you had a policy that was really unpopular and terrorists attacked the United States because of it, it's unlikely that the American people think, okay, well, let's end the problem by doing what the terrorists want. It's more likely let's end the problem by ending the terrorists. There'd be a so I think as a fact, as anyone guiding American foreign policy, whatever your sort of own views are, you need to make sure that people do understand this is the way it's likely to go.
And when you hear John Mearsheimer's analysis that the Bush administration is focused primarily on the Middle East and is determined to make the Middle East more like us at gunpoint if necessary, does that fit with your view of their strategy? And do you think it's the right way to go?
Well, I'd actually say, again, I don't know that John and I are going to be very satisfactory debating partners here because it sounded to me like he was saying that the strategy was pretty good, but there were some real tactical problems, which is more or less my view.
I'm not sure that's what I heard, John Mearsheimer.
No, I was
arguing. Well, that liberal democracy was a good thing, but how do we get it?
This is the principal reason that Walter and I disagreed on whether the Iraq War was a good idea. Walter believed that the Iraq War was a good idea and that we should make the Arabs fear us, and that would cow them into behaving in ways that suited America's national interest.
It's not what I thought I thought, but maybe you know better.
Pardon?
I said that's not what I thought I thought, John, but...
Walter Russell Mead, let me ask you, let me put it to you this way then. Do you see it as so, this grand strategy you see emerging, this American revival, as so focused on the Middle East? Or is that just one facet in your view of a larger context?
I would agree with John that it's clearly that the Middle East is now the strategic center of American thinking. And I would agree with John that the Bush administration is, you know, has thought that a big stick approach could bring liberal democracy in there. I have never agreed with that part of it. But I think it's a fact of life.
You supported the war against Iraq.
Yes, but not for that reason. John.
What was the reason?
Okay, my sense was that the containment of... I didn't actually support the way the Bush administration went into the war, but I did think that containment of Iraq was not working and was a very costly policy and was going to get worse and worse. And that we were going to have... We could not retreat from the goal of regime change. We were going to have to go forward. And I still think that's the case.
Despite, and you are very critical, I have to acknowledge, in the book of the way in which much of the war has been prosecuted. But
it reminds me of something that Abraham Lincoln, when he first met Mary Todd, went up to her and said, "Ma'am, I'd like to dance with you in the worst way." And later she said afterwards, that's exactly what he did. And I think that was, in some degree, the Bush administration's approach to the war in Iraq. But I do think that it is a fact of life now that for the American people and therefore for the American government, the Middle East is now the strategic center of the universe.
John Mearsheimer, we just have half a minute before the break, but in brief, was there a good way to invade and make war on Iraq that would have lined up with your view of proper American strategy?
No. The United States should not have invaded Iraq. First of all, we now know they didn't have WMD, and we had reasons to suspect that beforehand. But furthermore, even if they had WMD, they were not a major threat to us. And when you compare the outcome that we now have with what would have been the outcome had we not invaded in March of 2003, it seems obvious to me, and it must be obvious to huge chunks of the American people at this point in time, that it was a harebrained scheme to go into Iraq.
John Mearsheimer, Walter Russell Mead, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We are holding a kind of emergency debate tonight on America's grand strategy in the world, what it is, what it isn't, where we're headed. You can join the conversation. Are we in the birth pangs of a vital new global strategy, or is U.S. foreign policy going off off the rails. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're holding an emergency debate tonight, under fire, you might say, on America's grand strategy in the world, what it is, what it should be, where we're headed. You can join the conversation. Can the Bush administration be facing a near meltdown in Iraq and still be right on its strategic fundamentals? Is it time to reengage a multilateral approach to the world, or is that day done? Is it over? And is the Bush White House inspired by a grand new vision or blinded by it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Walter Russell Mead, Henry Kissinger, Senior Fellow at the U.S. Foreign Policy, in U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the new book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. And from Chicago, John Mearsheimer, Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago, author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Walter Russell Mead, let me quote just a bit from your book here. You talk about this new, bold vision inspired by an evolutionary step in capitalism, which can no longer be contained in old forms, affecting all the American, leading Americans' sense right now in this administration of the world and what it should be. You say, you call them American revivalists, and you write, the ambition of the American revivalist is not simply to add one more voice to the American chorus of political discussion. Their goal, and they are closer to it than many realize, is to replace the debate of the last 50 years with a new debate. They do not simply want to make the Republican Party the dominant party in American politics. They want to claim the terrain over which both parties contend. What is this shift in the debate that American revivalists are seeking, as you say, are pushing close to success in bringing?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the difference between the old American economy and the new American economy, that you had in the 1950s, 1960s, this kind of post-New Deal economy here and in other countries. National economies were relatively self-contained. You didn't have a lot of international competition the way we have it now, and certainly not from cheap third world competition. People would often have one job for their entire lives. You had pretty stable monopolies or oligopolies, and industry was pretty heavily regulated. And industry was actually pretty happy with that most of the time. Over the last 30, 40 years in the United States, we've been moving into a kind of a new system. It's not really a return to the laissez-faire capitalism of the old days.
But it has elements of the old days, of 19th century American values.
What's interesting is that, in a sense, in American politics, the weak point of the old New Deal coalition was that it was a very group-oriented kind of thing. You know, labor unions, voting blocs, big city machines. People were sort of deferential to the administrators and the bureaucrats. They were respected as experts. And American culture has usually been more individualistic than that. And then in the last 30 or 40 years, as the economy changes, that individualism is sort of coming back. And as that is happening, the American economy, you know, if you go back to the early 1980s, people thought that Germany and Japan were going to be ahead of the United States permanently. Now it seems that in this new economy, American culture is more suited to it, and we're going ahead, and the Germans and the Japanese in some ways seem to be falling back.
And celebrating the individual. So when the French or other foreign observers call George Bush a cowboy, are you saying they're right? And let's celebrate it?
Well, I'm not saying – I'm talking much more as a kind of a historian and an observer here than as a partisan. I think it's a real thing, this change, and it does no good to sort of pretend it doesn't – can't happen or to try to roll it back. I think it has good sides and bad sides. But I really think that what we have to do is live with it, learn to live with it, and learn to live – with some of the problems that it causes in American foreign policy, as well as some of the opportunities.
John Mearsheimer, Walter Russell Mead writes that you know, when you head into a new era and a new strategy to deal with it, as we did in the era of Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, he says, the froth and spray of the first waves of a new version of American grand strategy do not determine where the tide is headed, and the mistakes do not invalidate the general movement. What do you make, what's your sense of the general movement that he describes? Do we have a new kind of capitalism pushing a new kind of American stance toward the world, a new American foreign policy?
Well, when I look at American foreign policy, I don't see it being driven by changes in culture and changes in the American economy the way that Walter does. I think basically what's happened over the past 15 years is that the strategic environment, the geopolitical environment that the United States operates in, has changed in two fundamental ways. First of all, the Soviet Union has gone away with the end of the Cold War, and there's no great power out there that looks anything like Germany, Imperial Japan, and the Soviet Union did during the 20th century. And that's created all sorts of opportunities for the United States to roam around the world pretty much at will, because there's no other great powers to check it. The second important geopolitical change that's taken place is the rise of terrorism. The fact is that the United States does have a new enemy now that's of great strategic consequence. It's just that it's not another great power. It's Al-Qaeda. And therefore, we're focusing much of our attention on dealing with that problem. So I'd argue that it's geopolitical, not cultural and economic changes that are affecting our foreign policy these days.
Walter Russell Mead, you portray that terrorist threat as not any kind of small threat, not to suggest that John Mearsheimer does, but you describe, you say, the bin Ladenites and their allies and fellow travelers want to expel the United States from the Middle East and build a unified theocratic state that would control the oil resources of the Muslim Middle East. They would then use that power to consolidate their dictatorship, expand its influence throughout the Muslim world, and ultimately challenge the United States for global dominance.
That's their view of what they would like to accomplish, and I don't think it's very likely that they will achieve it. But that's the measure of the threat. That's the measure of their ambition. They're not, they're not sort of ethnic group terrorists saying we want more autonomy for Catalonia. They're people saying we want a fundamental change in ways that would affect American vital interests. So the problem's a serious one. I agree with John, by the way, on the geopolitical factors that are changing our foreign policy. But again, I think it's very important. We wouldn't have if we didn't have the Bush administration, we would probably have had a different response to those same geopolitical factors. And I think some of these changes that I've been describing in American society and the better ability of conservative Republicans to kind of harness and match themselves to these changes is what has put Bush rather than Gore in charge of American foreign policy, for example, for the last four. That, of course, and the Supreme Court.
So you're saying culture, everything from a fundamentalist Christian movement to kind of, as you described them, people who are grabbing on to millennial capitalism, more fluid capitalism, all that pushes the United States in this direction. Is it an altruistic project then, strategy then, at some level? Is it in line with at least the way America has seen itself historically as a bringer of light, freedom, democracy?
Well, it seems to me American foreign policy is always being made by a lot of different people with a lot of different motives. And, it's not like 19th century Prussia where, Bismarck's in charge and he does what he does because he wants to do it. So you have, in the Bush administration, you have some neoconservatives who sincerely thought and perhaps even still think that the liberal democratic transformation of Iraq is there. And they're really excited by this vision and they really see, in their own minds as a very benign thing what they're doing.
Even though it rolls on tank treads.
The American Revolution was fought. In American history, there's slavery was abolished in a civil war. Mm-hmm. War and morality are not always in some people's minds on opposite sides of the scale.
Mine eyes have seen the glory.
Exactly. So you've got people who really, really think that this is a great moral crusade. Then I think you've got some other people in the Bush administration who have a sort of strategic calculus at work. Then you have people who maybe have their doubts about the whole direction it's going in, but think they can do better by trying to slow it down. Some people would argue that, for example, Colin Powell would be in that camp.
Colin Powell's chief of staff, Larry Wilkerson, quoted in this new GQ magazine piece, saying that Paul Wolfowitz, of course, Donald Rumsfeld's neocon deputy, is a utopian like Lenin, and saying you're never going to bring utopia and you're only going to hurt a lot of people in the process of trying to do it. Is Iraq proof of that, Walter Russell Mead?
Again, I think the fact that they did something as complex as occupying Iraq without really having a strategy for how they were going to do it is definitely a sign that there was some utopian thinking at work. I think probably also they believed too much in the word of Iraqi exiles, Chalabi in particular.
He who will now not be part of the post-June 30 government, we're told.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, and it's possible some other heads will fall. But again, it's important to realize that, for example, the neocons, they're really not a lot of people individually. But the fact that the rise of evangelical Christianity in the United States in the last 30 years has created a large number of people who are suspicious of the United Nations, of universal government, who think multilateralism might be a bad thing inherently, and who also have a very strong view that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land is something that fulfills biblical prophecy. It means that a movement, an intellectual movement current like neoconservatism, can tap into a very broad range of public opinion.
I want to invite our callers in. Barry is calling from Bedford, New Hampshire. Hi, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. I bought a cell phone. I hope you can hear me okay.
Just fine, Barry.
All right. I really think that it's a lot simpler than it's being presented. I think it's just imperialism, simple, pure imperialism, a la maybe the British Empire, where you could install maybe, quote, democratic institutions, you do. But so far, our attempts at Afghanistan have fallen flat in their face. We can't even seem to get our troops out of the major cities in Afghanistan, and we've had our chance for, what, 2.5 years now?
It's been a while.
Yeah, and it isn't working there either. I think that the plans that the neocons had for Iraq were made right up front, and those plans were involved with military bases and installing Chalabi as a puppet. And that's all it was. Install a puppet dictator. Control the oil, control the resources, control the people, and, you know, you can make it seem democratic, but it's a joke. It's a joke.
So you're not willing to put the righteous raiments on this, Barry. We've got it. John Mearsheimer, we've heard, of course, this charge. This is imperialism, neo-imperialism. Does that help us understand U.S. strategy as it's unfolding in your mind?
Well, the problem with the word imperialism, it's a loaded term. Basically, what the author is describing is true. The Bush administration, in particular the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, were interested in going into the Middle East with American military force, establishing bases, and using our military to transform the region. In effect, what we were going to do is we were going to do social engineering that led to changes in the domestic politics and the foreign policies of most of the states in that region. Most people would define that as imperialism. And I think the fallback position for neoconservatives would be to say, maybe it is imperialism, but it's a benign form of imperialism. This is a benign empire or a benign form of hegemony. Of course, whether or not imperialism is benign or not depends on what end of the rifle barrel you're looking down.
But the argument...
people in the Arab and Islamic world don't see our form of behavior over there is benign.
But the argument that we hear, and it's reflected in Walter Russell Mead's book, is that some of the old institutions for addressing this, the institutions that once held American strategy and American vision of the future, have been made irrelevant or ineffective by economic changes, changes in kind of transnational power flows that the United Nations just isn't up to the challenges that the world is facing now.
Look at who the Bush administration is now turning to help pull their chestnuts out of the fire in Iraq, the United Nations, Lakhdar Brahimi. They've asked him to go over there and come up with a solution to the transition problem of June 30th of this year. So we're going back to the United Nations. We're going back to allies. In fact, what we're doing is moving away from unilateralism because it's failed in Iraq, and we're turning to multilateralism. So the idea that these institutions no longer work is simply wrongheaded. The strategy that doesn't work is unilateralism, and the whole idea that you can do massive social engineering in the Middle East at the end of a rifle barrel. That argument is washed up on the rocks in Iraq. It should be clear to almost everybody at this point in time.
Walter Russell Mead, are the facts in Iraq putting pay to the idea that the UN is history? Does it suggest that there was maybe more too much arrogance in the view that led to U.S. involvement there, to the grand strategy that you're in part describing, this American revival.
Well, I think definitely there was some overreaching by the neocons in Iraq, and again, particularly the fact that they announced such incredibly far-reaching political objectives and then had so little in the way of even serious planning to do it suggests just a basic failure, you know, as I say in the book, really almost an unprecedented failure.
But does it fundamentally puncture, discredit the grand strategy that you're describing is driven by economics and a kind of revival of 19th century American vigor around individualism?
I think it's more like water flowing down a hill, and it's blocked in one channel. It'll find another way to flow. I think the forces that are creating this kind of drift in American foreign policy are going to continue to seek an outlet, and they're going to continue to be powerful. For example, yes, they're calling in Brahimi, thank goodness, in Iraq, and let's hope he's successful. But the basic problem of how do you deal with proliferation in a multilateral context remains tough, because what we're now seeing is that neither the multilateral institutions nor American intelligence have been successful in assessing the state of WMD preparations in Iraq. They overestimated. You know, Tenet told George Bush it was a slam dunk case. In Pakistan, U.S. intelligence and the multilateral monitoring system not only missed that Pakistan was about to explode a bomb, but it missed that Pakistan was having a kind of a nuclear technology bazaar.
What does it mean for fundamental strategy?
Well, what that means is that we're on something of a knife edge. If you think that opposing proliferation is a vital American interest, and I think you'd probably find that most of the American people do feel that very strongly, and yet multilateral institutions no longer seem able to do the job of preventing proliferation. Now, maybe in some places they can, and then you go with them, but you do sort of have to think about what your other options are, and I don't think that's going to go away.
John Mearsheimer, we've got a minute before the break. Is it old-fashioned 20th century thinking to look to the UN beyond Mr. Brahimi and the crunch of the moment and see it as the vehicle that can lead to a bright and peaceful future for the U.S. and the world?
Well, I think that overstates the case to say that the UN can lead to a bright and future and a peaceful world. I mean, it puts too much of a burden on the UN. The UN is a useful instrument for the United States. The United States can use it to help solve some problems and help manage the world, just like we're doing in Iraq at this point in time. The problem with the Bush administration is in the run-up to the Gulf War and in the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War, they did nothing but diss the United Nations and did everything they could to avoid using it in Iraq. And they got themselves into real trouble as a result. If they were smart, they would have used the UN for their own selfish purposes. So I think the UN does have an important role to play for the United States. It's not going to solve all the world's problems by any means, but it's certainly not the problem.
John Mearsheimer, Walter Russell Mead, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about American grand strategy. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at America's grand strategy in the world tonight, what it is, what it should be, where we are headed. I'm joined tonight by Walter Russell Mead, author of the new book Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk, and from the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, professor there and author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. You can join the conversation. Is the United States plagued right now by manageable tactical missteps or by a fundamental strategic misconception? Where do you plant your strategic flag for the 21st century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bruce is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment about getting into the war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. It is something that I think we had to do, but I've never heard anybody discuss, or rarely heard anybody discuss, the reasons I think we should have, and that was we put him in power. We were the means by which he took power because of our support, and he was making life for his own people terrible. That is the reason we should have gone in, to clean up our own mess.
Well, he took some pretty bold steps himself in getting into power, but there was a lot of American alliance along the way. That's true.
Right. And what I'm against, and have been ever since the subject first came up, was Bush's way of doing it. the man is inarticulate, rude, and arrogant. And what amazes me is if any other country would come and try to dictate to us the way we want to go and dictate to the rest of the world, we'd be incensed by it. Why is it so hard for the American politicians to understand this? Why should the rest of the world be any different than us? They don't want us to be stepping all over their way of life any more than we would tolerate them doing it to us.
Bruce, we've got it loud and clear, and thank you for your call. Walter Russell Mead, it reminds me of something I saw David Remick write recently in The New Yorker. He called the Bush team's approach to foreign policy condescending absolutism. Is there a way to act on this gung-ho, revved-up American revival that doesn't end up getting up people's noses and turning them into enemies, even if you've got some good core ideas?
You know, I think part of we have to talk about a maturation process in some of the people and some of the officials, some of the supporters in the movements. People have got, learning that your most precious ideas, you take them out in Iraq and they don't work that well in the field. You know, hopefully that's a learning experience for people.
That's a pretty expensive learning experience, isn't it? I mean, we're talking many billions, many dead, global alienation.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, think about we learned some tough lessons in World War II as well. The Cold War, not all of the policy choices that we made were the right ones. It's called history. And that doesn't mean that the people who make mistakes don't have a major responsibility, moral and personal and historic. They do. But as a fact of life, powers, countries make mistakes in their foreign policy.
John Mearsheimer, do you think we're reaching a kind of crisis point around American strategy right now? And speaking of history, where do you think it will ultimately push American grand strategy in the decade or two ahead?
Well, I think it's quite clear that we're reaching a crisis point. The fact of the matter is that the war in Iraq is going very badly, and nobody can tell a story that as to how this one ends happily. And I think our overall position in the Middle East is deteriorating daily. This controversy over the torture of prisoners in Iraqi prisons is a total disaster for the United States. So our situation is dire, for sure. Now, where is this headed? It's difficult to say with any certainty, but it seems quite clear that the United States is going to have to fundamentally alter its policy in the region, and most importantly, we're going to have to figure a way on how to get out of Iraq as quickly as possible and leave behind something that approximates a stable government.
And does that mean going back to multilateral world approach or going forward to a more effectively executed American revival, muscular American revival?
Well, in my opinion, it involves neither. I think what the United States should do vis-a-vis the Middle East is what it did during the Cold War, and that is to act as an offshore balancer. The United States should get almost all of its military forces out of the region and keep them far away, develop an over-the-horizon capability like we had during the Cold War in the Rapid Deployment Force, and not go into that region unless it's absolutely necessary. We have to reduce the size of our military footprint. The fact of the matter is that building an empire in the Middle East is not going to solve the terrorism problem. It's going to make it worse.
John Mearsheimer, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago and Walter Russell Mead, author of the new book, Power, Terror, Peace and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. About 10 minutes from now, tens of millions of Americans will bid farewell to Ross, Monica, Rachel, Chandler, Joey, and Phoebe, the cast of Friends.
Was he holding you, or were his hands, like, on your back?
No, actually, first they started out on my waist, and then they slid up, and then they were in my hair.
Oh.
And then I kissed her.
Tongue?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I just don't buy it.
Excuse me. Evolution is not for you to buy, Phoebe. Evolution is scientific fact, like the air we breathe, like Gravity.
Oh, okay. Don't get me started on gravity.
I didn't know it was a big secret.
Oh, it's not big. Not at all. You know, kind of the same lines as, say, oh, I don't know, having a third nipple.
Smelly Cash, Smelly Cash, it's not your fault.
Monica!
They won't take you to the vet.
Chandler!
Obviously not their favorite pet.
Joey!
May not be a bed of roses.
Rachel!
You're not friends of those with noses.
Ross, those are the only lines we have, sorry. Okay, that's
After spending 10 seasons as one of the country's top 10 rated television programs, NBC's Friends signs off tonight, with the series finale of another longtime sitcom, Frasier, coming next week, and with no heir apparent waiting in the wings, some are asking if the situation comedy is coming to an end as a genre. Robert Thompson is the director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Earlier today, I asked him why Friends was able to attract so many viewers for so long in an age when most sitcoms struggle to survive.
Well, I think there were three things. The first and most obvious, really good casting and really good writing. These were this was a cast of people that found their chemistry within the first 10 minutes of the pilot episode, and it really never gave out the entire decade. And importantly, they were given really funny things to say. This was a very competent, well-done sitcom. I don't know that I'd put it in the top 10 best sitcoms ever made, but it certainly delivered everything that it promised.
And what about the Friends zeitgeist? What was it?
Well, that was the second thing, was that this show did for an emerging generation of people what the Mary Tyler Moore Show had done way back in 1970. When Mary Tyler Moore came out, it domesticated, it made normal, it brought to television this idea of changing gender roles, the notion of the independent woman, and the idea that, in fact, family was often found more in the workplace, people you often spent more time with, than it was actually when you went home at the end of the day. Friends did something similar. It took this generation of people that were delaying forming usual families, kids, in-laws, spouses, and sometimes delaying it by a decade from what their parents had done, and maybe even longer from what their grandparents had done. But then they cleaned it all up. They made it all seem like a happy utopia. Friends gave you this notion that you could live life like it was in a college dormitory right on into your 30s. And I think that was very comforting to people at 8 o'clock who weren't looking for reality, who weren't looking for a message, who weren't looking for sociology. They were looking for anesthesia. They were looking for escape. And boy, did Friends ever deliver that.
And then the interactions and the setting, New York, in a time when New York was, again, in the ascendant.
Right. This took that whole idea of young people in New York, of this city as a playground, and resuscitated that idea, which had been long in the American heart in other segments of our history. And then it never let go of that. Even when this show returned after September 11th, which, by the way, it did with great fanfare and its ratings spiked considerably, it wisely simply chose to ignore that that had ever happened. This was about a New York that you could, on a waitress salary, live in a palatial apartment. This was about a New York where you could leave your doors unlocked for your friends to come barging in. And, of course, it was a New York where people weren't flying airplanes into buildings. I think people found that like a sorbet that cleared the palate of all of that news that they had been getting for the last 2 months before the schedule finally kicked in again in fall of 2000.
So now it's passing on. Is that because this notion of the urban tribe, the young postgraduate folks hanging out in the city, has become passé? It's no longer titillating?
No, I don't think Friends is passing on because what it represented is no longer relevant. What Friends documented and what it represented is still very much how a lot of people expect to live when they get out of college or when they turn 18. I think Friends is passing on because it was finished doing what it was doing. It was wearing out. Those people were getting old.
Yeah.
10 years is long enough to stay stuck in second gear. It was becoming dangerously close to shifting from being charming about free and funny people into just being a show about people that were kind of pathetic. And one more season I don't think would have been good for this show at all.
A little bit of the Sex and the City problem there. So here goes Friends, and at the same time, Frasier, also very long-running, 11 years, very witty, lots of fans. And all of this has raised the notion, Bob Thompson, that perhaps with these two big shows going, we are witnessing the death of the sitcom. What do you say?
I say that it's going to take a lot more than this to kill off the sitcom. It's still, with reality TV and all these Law and Orders and CSI notwithstanding, The sitcom, in the long run, I think is still the basic grammatical unit of television. And we've seen this before. Back in the 83-84 season, there was a single sitcom in the top 10, Kate and Allie, and that was really nothing special. Everybody had written the obituary of the sitcom. The next year, Cosby came out, and a 20-year run of the sitcom played some of the best shows ever made. This is a very arid period for the sitcom. There's no question about it. With the departure of Friends and Frasier, an era has ended that started way back in 82 with the debut of Cheers. But I have no doubt that the sitcom will be back. There is an appetite for that stuff out there, and any network executive in their right mind is now desperately looking for 8 o'clock and 8:30 comedies to provide their varied menu that they need to provide to survive.
What gives you such confidence in that? As you say, reality TV has eaten up tons of evening television time. The audience is famously splintering off in many different directions. Is there still a kind of common family or office that the whole country can sit around, or bar, as an old Cheers case, can sit around and be enthusiastic about, be absorbed in?
Not necessarily. Clearly, the audience now is considerably smaller than it was before. Everybody is not feeding from the same cultural trough. They are spread off into other venues. We're going to prove that tonight. NBC is expecting 50 million for Friends. MASH in 1983 got 100 million in its final episode, twice what Friends is going to get. Nevertheless, I think the success of Friends up to and including this season, the success of Frasier up to and including this season, and Raymond, demonstrate that there is still, even in a world filled with bachelorettes and apprentices and survivors, there's still a very strong appetite for some other things besides reality and drama and the rest of it. And I think the reason the sitcom isn't doing very well right now is that there aren't very many good sitcoms out there, and it takes a lot more to make a good sitcom because the bar's been raised considerably. After 20 years of Cheers and Seinfeld and Friends and Frasier and The Simpsons, we don't make hits out of shows like Gimme a Break anymore, and there just aren't that many people out there who can make good ones.
So if the sitcom's not dead, Bob Thompson, what's the next big one going to look like?
Well, whatever the next sitcom is that's going to be as big as Friends and Seinfeld and the rest of it has not yet debuted. I don't think there's anything on the schedule now that's going to suddenly explode and become this huge, big hit. However, I think the next sitcom that does do that is probably going to be pretty traditional. All of these fancy shows that critics like and that are very artistic, from Scrubs to Arrested Development to Sports Night and all of the rest of them, they're interesting, they get a decent audience, but they never become big, huge hits. I think in the end, what people want about a sitcom is a show they can enjoy when they're half asleep, when they're in the other room, when they're not paying attention. Sitcoms are about anesthesia, and it's why I think Friends was, when all is said and done, a very old-fashioned sitcom, and I think the next batch of hits are going to be old-fashioned as well.
So comfort food, maybe particularly in a hard world.
Absolutely. I think at any time, good times, bad times, the hot bowl of soup that sitcoms provide is going to be in demand all the time, regardless of what else is going on the rest of the television schedule.
Well, goodbye to all that with Friends. Its last show is tonight. Bob Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Thompson is professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. NBC's Friends bows out at 9 o'clock Eastern Time tonight. Off they go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.